All I want to do is... Oh, hold on.
Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
Zoom, 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 and a boom, boom.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com for comprehensive show notes, printable Halloween masks, book suggestions, or to just leave comments. Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast. And get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project. And here's Bert.
Hey, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is June 15th. For you younger folks, the old school rap lyric in the intro gag for this show, that was a reference to the 1992 song Rump Shaker by Rex in FX. If you were old enough to know that, you probably agree, that was pretty awesome. So this is part three in the Adverse Childhood Experiences and Resilience series. Today, Wes, Matt, and I will go through questions 5 through 10. Before we go any further, I think it's important to point out, I've noticed the download counts for these shows significantly lower than the material that was put out right before. So that observation feeds my concern that this continues to be a real third rail topic. That's the one you don't touch in this larger discussion and quest for free yourselves and a freer world if you're looking for a really big project. So if you are finding value in these shows, I would encourage you to repost, to share on Facebook, to share on Twitter. And of course, the challenge there is, even if you recognize the potential value of this exploration, if you've observed how helpful it can be in your own lives, you still hit a pretty solid wall when trying to bring it to people who are unwilling or who aren't ready. And that can be somewhat frustrating. And I say that because I used to be a part of that wall. And it's an ongoing process. There are certain times or when confronting certain issues or certain behaviors where I do have to say a part of me wants to go and reassimilate with that wall. And it's having friends like the ones you're going to hear on the show today that are so helpful in resisting that temptation. So it's worth thinking about ways to present this, if you feel this way, of course, as a pretty important set of revelations in the quest for more personal freedom in life. So the feedback that has come in has been very positive. There's one other thing that I do want to address. I've listened back to these shows as I edited them, and I want to make it especially clear, I guess this would be for people who are really new, this is not in any way a promotion of a victim mentality, even though there is discussion and reflection on difficult things that happen to us in life. I really see this as an exercise that is in line with the first three pillars of self-esteem as Nathaniel Brandon laid them out, living consciously, a willingness to look at the facts, whether we like them or not. Then, of course, self-acceptance, the second pillar. We make very real to ourselves the thoughts, the feelings, actions that we're doing that throw us off or that cause us difficulty or stress in life. We don't cast them away or exile them. And the third pillar, of course, self-responsibility. We are responsible, not victims, blaming this or that for whatever difficulties we face, not indulging in feelings of guilt or feelings of shame or worried about not living up to a specific person's standards or the cultural standards, good heavens. The recognition that we are individuals who, as Brandon states, are responsible for our choices and actions. Quote, to be responsible in this context means responsible not as the recipient of moral blame or guilt, but responsible as the chief causal agent in our lives and behavior. And in a final and more personal note, which also, I guess, can serve as a reiteration of this idea that this is not about promoting a victim mentality, in preparation for recording these shows, I had long one-on-one conversations with both of my parents. The second and third parts in this series are pretty revealing. And one of the reasons why I decided to go ahead with this is that this world does not overlap with theirs in any way. Neither of them listen to the show. You know, they are never named by name, and they know why these types of explorations are important for me at this stage in my life. The conversations that I had with them, the one-on-one conversations I mentioned a minute ago, were about their childhoods. And I asked them to provide as much information as they could from memory about their parents, my grandparents. And a bulk of those conversations, especially in my mother's case, wound up being about the childhoods of my grandparents. One story was about my maternal grandfather, who was the son of Italian immigrants, and they lived in the greater Boston area. And this was in the 1920s. So my great-grandfather, this Italian immigrant, was a mason, not the kind that run the world, just the kind that actually build things. His name was Fidele. He was a real penny pincher. He was married to a woman. My mother described it as essentially an arranged marriage. They didn't get along too well. They had three children. She wound up taking up with somebody else who lived in the tenement building where they lived. I think my great-grandfather owned it. And she decided to run off with this man. Her short-term, very short-term solution was to tie my grandfather, who at the time was maybe four, along with his two sisters, to the kitchen stove so they would not hurt themselves or each other, and took off with this other man. My grandfather turned out to be a very worldly and successful man, but he never spent a day in therapy, and that trauma went somewhere. The woman that he married and later divorced, I believe when my mom was a teenager, was one of 10 children, and their father, my other maternal great-grandfather, died when I think she was 11 or 12. She was one of the oldest children, if not the oldest child, in that family of 10 at that time. He died 2 days before Christmas, and my mother told me the story about her mother taking down the Christmas tree to make room for his coffin for the wake at Christmas time. My grandmother also never spent a day in therapy, that I know of anyway. My memories of her are fairly sparse. She died when I was 5. It was how I learned about death. All I can remember is that she was very nice to me, but she smoked a hell of a lot, and she died of a heart attack when she was in her mid-50s. Now, I include this in an effort to communicate that it was really important for me to be able, in these shows, telling fairly difficult stories, to come from an empathetic place for the experiences of my parents. Now, it's been suggested in the past, I've heard people make this suggestion to me, that it is proper to be angry at our parents, and that we should dismiss the idea that they did the best they could. After all, they could have read books about how to do a better job. I remember my parents' bedroom was very big, and it had like 2 rooms, and the front room was this library area. There were a lot of books about parenting in there. They were in like a book of the month club. But it turned out that a pile of books by Dr. Spock couldn't really do much against the momentum of this intergenerational transfer of childhood trauma, especially if that concept was never made explicit to them, followed, of course, by some kind of plan of action for how to address it. And I'm not really sure how that would have happened then. I'm not saying it's impossible. Everybody could always do better if they have the tools and the resources and the information to do so. So that is what we humbly attempt here. This third part is a big one. Here we go. When I was a baby, I had
There is perhaps nothing more important to know about children than that they need to make sense out of their experience. In effect, they need to know that the universe is rational. They need to know that human existence is knowable, predictable, and stable. On that foundation, they can build a sense of efficacy. Without it, the task is worse than difficult. Sanity in family life is one of a child's most urgent needs if healthy development is to be possible. What does sanity mean in this context? It means adults who, for the most part, say what they mean and mean what they say. It means rules that are understandable, consistent, and fair. It means not being punished today for behavior that was ignored or even rewarded yesterday. It means a home in which reality is appropriately acknowledged. It means parents who practice what they preach, who are willing to admit when they make mistakes and apologize when they know they have been unfair or unreasonable. It means parents who reward and reinforce consciousness in a child rather than discourage and penalize it. If, instead of obedience, we want cooperation from our children, if, instead of conformity, we want self-responsibility, we can achieve it in a home environment that supports the child's mind. We cannot achieve it in an environment intrinsically hostile to the exercise of mind. We want to teach our children healthy ideas and values. Ideas and values are most powerfully communicated when they are embedded into family life, rooted into the being of the parents. Regardless of what we think we're teaching, we teach what we are.
I'm Pete Gerlach. I'm the author of the Break the Cycle nonprofit website. I want to introduce you to a very complex, controversial subject that I've been studying for almost 30 years as a professional therapist and as the son of two functional alcoholics. I want to offer you a summary of my observation about the widespread stressor of addiction. Let me suggest, addiction is not a character flaw, it's not a disease, it's not a disease. It's not caused by a weak will. Addiction serves a purpose. It is to self-medicate reliably against inner pain. What is inner pain? Inner pain is unbearable combination of shame, guilt, fear, or anxiety, emptiness, sadness, confusion. Those can feel overwhelming when a person is not taught at an early age how to recognize and deal with them. Most of us have inner pain from time to time. The challenge of being human is, how do we manage our inner pain? Because many people grow up in dysfunctional, low-nurturance families. They're not taught how to either recognize or manage their pain. What they discover, in part because of social imprinting and examples all around us, is that addiction is a reliable medication that makes the pain go away for a while. The paradox is addiction increases inner pain, specifically shame, guilt, and hopelessness. So addiction is an automatic, unconscious reflex by people who are feeling too much inner pain. Where does this pain come from? Usually, in my experience as a veteran therapist, it comes from the early years of being raised in a low-nurturance or dysfunctional family. Adults who themselves are psychologically wounded and inherited ignorance from their ancestors do their best to raise their children, but frequently they don't meet their kids' needs. And when that happens, kids accumulate inner pain. What can you do about addictions? can you cure them? The prevailing answer is no. Can you reduce them? In my experience as a veteran therapist, the answer is yes. What's required to reduce or manage versus cure an addiction? There are several things that need to happen. First, a so-called addict, which is a code word for someone who is psychologically wounded and in great pain. The addict has to hit bottom. She or he has to wake up one morning or reach a point in the afternoon or evening that says, I cannot tolerate living like this one more moment. I am going to change. Bottoms are of two types. There are real bottoms where people do change permanently. And there are trial or pseudo bottoms where they try for a while and then they fall back into their own self-medication habits. So, the first thing that usually has to happen, there are exceptions, is a person who is self-medicating needs to hit bottom. Secondly, for a successful end, or management at least, of addictions, and there are four kinds of addictions, by the way, they all work the same way. The most widely known is addictions to substances, including food, by the way. Food is a drug. It alters your mood and your physiology and your hormones. People can become addicted to the process of eating and to food itself, specifically sugar and carbohydrates, because those change our bodies and our brains and give us temporary pleasure. They make the pain go down. So you can be addicted to substances. You can be addicted to activities like betting, gambling, for instance. You can be addicted to moods like rage, which feels powerful. And if you're shame-based, the last thing you've ever experienced is feeling powerful. So you can become addicted to moods, substances, activities, including shopping, for instance, or cleaning, or working out. Those can become unhealthy compulsions, which are no longer, you can't control them by willpower. That's what a compulsion is. It's action that you cannot control with mental boundaries. The last kind of addiction to a relationship. The popular name for that is codependence. It works just like the other three kinds of addictions. You become so focused compulsively on another person, on their welfare, on their behavior, on their appearance, on how they relate to you, that you lose sight of yourself. Alias, you forget about or minimize or numb out your inner pain. So there are four kinds of addictions. To begin to manage them, you have to hit bottom. The next thing, in my experience, is you need to free your true self to manage your personality. That probably will mean nothing to you unless you've studied lesson one in the Break the Cycle website. There are eight lessons there. The first lesson is how to recognize if you're ruled by a false self, which most people are, and how to free your wise, true self. In order to manage an addiction, you must do that. There are exceptions, but it makes the likelihood of, quote, recovery from addiction much higher. Then you need to identify, the third step is identify specifically what is your inner pain. That's easy to say, it's hard to do. Inner pain can be a mix of, as I said, excessive shame. I'm a terrible person. I'm unlovable. I'm ugly. I'm stupid. I'm a failure. Inner shame. That starts in our first 6 years of life. Excessive guilt. I do bad things. It feels the same as shame, but it's different. Excessive fear is a widespread, perhaps universal, cause of inner pain. I fear the unknown. I fear failure. I fear intimacy. I fear success. I fear fear. I fear relationships. If you're taking risks. So that's a source of inner pain. Another source of inner pain, which is a little more difficult to recognize, is reality distortion. Another way we manage inner pain is to distort reality, to reduce our discomfort. The primary example is denial. What? Inner pain? I don't have any inner pain. Oh, yes, you do. The signs are unmistakable. So identify specifically your inner pain. Identify what promotes your inner pain. Frequently, that has to do with your childhood. If you do what's called in lesson one, parts work. You can identify the personality subcells that bring you each one of these sources of pain. And over time, with respect and patience and help and creativity, you can reduce each one of these sources of pain. When you do that, your need to self-medicate goes down. The last thing you need to do, in addition to hitting bottom, freeing yourself, and reducing your inner pain proactively and intentionally, the last thing you need to do is identify if you're living in a low-nurturance or pain-promoting environment. You need to change your environment and get into one which promotes healthy living and healthy pain management. Frequently, that means you have to reorganize your relations with your dysfunctional family members and or spouse. This is a very complicated process. Addiction is not a disease. It is not a character flaw. It is an unconscious attempt to medicate inner pain. It is not subject to willpower because the inner pain dominates. Addiction can be reduced once you're aware of what causes inner pain, how to reduce it, how to manage it, and how to seek a more healthy, functional environment. In the bottom line, addiction is a family problem, not an individual problem. Yes, of course, individuals suffer from addictions, but really, addiction is an indication of major family dysfunction. In 1986, I found through, quote, chance, that I was an ACOA. That meant nothing to me at the time. I now know it means adult child of an alcoholic parent or an alcoholic family, ACOA, also known as ACA, adult children of alcoholics. My discovery in 1986 virtually changed my personal and professional life. I have studied addictions, and that led to the study of dysfunctional families, and that has led to the study of childhood trauma and the psychological results of childhood trauma, parental abandonment, abuse, and neglect. And that has led me to theorize that there is an unseen cycle of psychological wounds and ignorance that is passing down our generations, and that may, in fact, have affected you and any children you may be raising. What I've discovered as a therapist, I've worked with many, many troubled individuals and couples. A routine question that I have asked early in the work is, do you think either of your parents or the adults that raised you were addicted? A common theme to the answers I get is, well, I don't know, but he or she, mom or dad or somebody, drank a lot. Many people are unclear how to judge what a true addiction is, and they are reluctant to brand their parent as an addict. Frequently, when I ask further questions about characteristics of my client or student, I find that they have the exact same characteristics as we ACOAs. There are four types of addictions, by the way, not just alcoholism. If you think that possibly one or more of the adults that raised you was an addict, that is cause to be highly alert, because you may have, without knowing it, inherited up to 6 psychological wounds. Quickly, they are these: excessive shame and excessive guilt. Those are separate but similar. Excessive fears, which can manifest as chronic worrying or anxiety. Excessive reality distortions, the most common of which is denial. Major problems with trust, trusting people too easily and getting betrayed, or not trusting trustworthy people. Distorted thinking is another characteristic of we ACOAs. Another unfortunate, sad, major wound that many of us have is an inability to form healthy, normal, real bonds with other human beings. We have very great difficulty with intimacy, feeling our feelings, and giving or exchanging love. If either of or any of your ancestors, including grandparents, by the way, had the characteristics of addictions, it's probable that you have inherited two or more of these wounds. A big one that I did not mention, but is the core wound of all, is a fragmented personality which causes your life to be controlled by what can be called a false self. If you have a childhood adult who might have been or surely was addicted, or if you have personal characteristics like these, low self-esteem, or an extremely high opinion of yourself, which some people might call egotism or a superiority complex, you feel often significantly guilty about various things. You are chronically anxious or worried or pessimistic or cynical or sarcastic. You tend to do black or white thinking. They're right or they're wrong. You're safe, you're on time, or you're late. You're with me or you're against me. It's my way or the highway. If you think like that, that is a characteristic of having wounded parents. If you trust too easily, or if you don't trust at all, or very, very guardedly, if you have trouble with intimacy, if people say that you're cold or unfeeling or unempathic, if some people have hinted or said that you don't seem genuine, you seem phony, or that you have several different personalities, like you can be friendly and you can be enraged, if you are judged to be or you see yourself as being controlling or manipulative, if you are clingy, or if you are uncomfortable with physical touching or hugging or appropriate non-sexual contact, if you're sexually dysfunctional. These are some of up to 40 identifiable, observable behavioral traits of adult children of alcoholics, and more to the point, adult children of dysfunctional childhood families. My purpose in this video is to introduce you, in case you're not familiar with it, to the term ACOA, also known as ACA. This term came about, by the way, in the 1980s. There was an explosion of information and public knowledge in those days, just 30 years, about the scourge of alcoholism, which has been known throughout all cultures, throughout all ages. People began to see in the 1980s alcoholism was a family problem, not just an individual one. There were people who were addicted to the welfare of an addict. They became known as co-addicts, co-alcoholics, and that generalized, because it was so widespread, into codependence. That led to the popular discovery of the wounded inner child. We now know that there are multiple inner children. And it led to the discovery of ACOA characteristics that I just highlighted for you. So we've come a long way in 30 years. I would estimate, as a professional veteran therapist, at least 70% of average men and women, with or without college education, of all races, all backgrounds, at least 70% carry significant psychological wounds, and a high percentage of them don't know it or what it means. That means, one of the things it means, is they are in danger of passing their psychological wounds on to their vulnerable young children, just as their ancestors passed their wounds on to them.
So we begin hour three. And production note, we stop at the top of every hour to run the air conditioner for 10 minutes. Because it is, you know, I feel like I was just complaining about how cold it was. Like, I feel like that was yesterday.
Yeah, a month ago.
Yeah, yeah. Now it's too hot. So we're picking back up. We are in the middle of going through the questions on the Adverse Childhood Experiences study, and we are on number 5. Did you often or very often feel that you didn't have enough to eat, had to wear dirty clothes, and had no one to protect you? Or your parents were too drunk or too high to take care of you or take you to the doctor if you needed it? That's one. A lot of these make me think a lot about experiences that I had close to this, but for me, that has to be a no. I mean, I remember as my parents' marriage deteriorated, I think I had come to expect certain things, like laundry would be done, there would be dinner, and things that I felt like were predictable parts of life started to change, but I never felt neglected as far as basic physical needs.
What age were you when
you thought your parents' marriage started to deteriorate. You know, I know that they got officially divorced when you were 21.
Yeah.
But how old were you when you thought, and how old are you now looking back when the marriage started to deteriorate?
I remember being like in the latter half of elementary school. I don't have any positive memories of them really as a couple.
So like nine or 10.
Yeah. I remember one time we all went to this party in the neighborhood. It was like a pig roast party. And it was the only time in my life. My dad's a pretty heavy drinker, but I've never seen him drunk except for this one time where he was clearly like tipsy. And I remember I was probably 12. And my parents came home from the party and they both sat together on the couch. And my mom was kind of like leaning this way. And my dad sat and actually put his head like on her hip. I'd never even seen them like touch each other, you know? So I remember like looking at that and thinking like, wow, that's so weird.
You didn't see any affection between your mom and dad?
Hardly any, like very, very rare. And you'd have to go way back for me to remember something like that. I have very few memories of anything like that.
I mean, it's similar for me.
Yeah.
And, you know, now with my kids, they see, you know, Molly and I are affectionate. Mm-hmm. My kids have no question about the fact that Molly and I love them very much. If you would see your parents never really loving each other, how could they love you as a kid? You know, like if they could barely stand each other, and how are you supposed to then model that when you're supposed to be affectionate with someone? You know, you have no role model for being affectionate with someone of the opposite sex.
Or what being happy in a relationship looks mm-hmm. like, which in a big part of that, like being able to identify things like that brings a lot of security, you know, like this is... I know the comfort is kind of not the ideal word for relationships because a lot of people equate it in relationships with laziness, you know, or kind of stagnation. But I think a kind of security in a loving relationship is important. If you don't know what a healthy one looks like, it's really hard to have that, I think. I remember when we did, Wes, we did this show based on Breaking Free and based on the shows that Wes did on Breaking Free. And at the beginning, I used this clip of Adam Carolla. And he was talking about, he was being interviewed on this show called You Made It Weird. And he talked about how important it was for his kids to see him doing things that made him happy. For his kids to get the idea that he was happy. Because all he remembered about being a child and his relationship with his parents is how shitty he felt about them always being miserable. Mm-hmm. You know, and that really, really spoke, not an Adam Carolla fan personally, but that really, really spoke to me. Trying to learn that.
Were your parents happy?
My mom was not happy. No. That was why it was such an amazing achievement to make her laugh, to do something funny that she would get a kick out of, or to say that, or to get praise for being funny. Yeah, I mean, I can remember her laughing. I could remember her enjoying time with her friends. My father was very, very, and still is to a large degree, like very stoic, kind of prides himself in being a little bit of a jokester, but he always has to tell people like that was a joke. Like then he'll say, oh, I guess you're not that funny if you make a joke and then have to tell people it was a joke. But, you know, he's stoic about certain things like emotionally. He will laugh and he has a decent sense of humor. But I remember feeling like he wasn't always the person to go to with what was like a troubling emotional issue. Like, oh, well, you know, stop doing that then. Would kind of be the answer. Like, you know, I remember I was just talking to him about, you know, different problems that I was having. And, you know, it was, you know, sometimes, have you guys seen the video? It's called It's Not About the Nail.
I have not.
Anyone in the peanut gallery? It's Not About the Nail. Wes, have you ever seen that video? It's Not About the Nail.
It's Not About the Nail. Oh, yeah, I have.
Yeah.
That's a fascinating commentary, isn't it?
It's a brilliant video, but it makes having emotions look kind of silly. Right.
Well, I think it's about male, female. Like, I get that a lot. You just want to fix it.
And we've all heard that. Men are from Mars. Yeah.
So there are some roles being played there, right?
Yeah. Well, I think when somebody that's kind of like when you want some empathy for how you're feeling and somebody's like, oh, no, just do this. You know, it's not always so obvious. You know, like I could see if I had a nail in my head, but
portraying her as really naive.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, if there's a nail in her head, she's going to notice that and pull it out and attend to it. But it's kind of dramatizing the nature of this not feeling heard and understood process.
And then the other thing is, it's like you also kind of feel rejected, or it, part of it is like this subtle shame, like, oh no, you just do this. Like, why didn't you think of doing this? You know, so it's like, yes, I want connection and empathy, and I'm not going to get that, but I'm also getting this, no, stupid, you just do this thing. So the need that you go into that interaction with is definitely not met. Mm-hmm. I felt that way quite a bit. Not hearing things like, yeah, I understand, or yeah, I've been through that. That's hard.
So when parents aren't feeling connected to their own emotions, how do they respond to child's emotions?
Right.
Right. And how did they respond? How were they responded to when they were children? You know, are we just reliving this intergenerational transfer process? Yeah.
And then how do we break the cycle is the next in the series.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So for me, that's a no. You know, I was pretty well taken care of physically.
For me,
no here.
Yeah. So that's a no for all three of us.
And my dad was a functional alcoholic.
Yeah, same.
So he wasn't ever stumbling drunk, unable to take care of those basic things.
Six, were your parents ever separated or divorced? It's a one for me.
Yep.
One for you.
Well, technically not, but I would say it probably is for you, right? Because they were 21. Or were they separated before that?
That was interesting. I mean, separated is kind of, in most cases, a legal term. My parents were separated emotionally most of my life. I mean, my dad was finding these, even as like 13, 14, 15 years old, what I identified as kind of these bizarre travel excursions. Like he would go to Italy to look for business opportunities. It seemed like that my parents' marriage falling apart was kind of like helping determine my dad's travel schedule a little bit. Cause I just remember him being gone for like, by the time I was 16, like when I was at like a really, really crucial time, the school environment was saying, hey, Brett, here's booze. Hey, Brett, here's pot. Hey, Brett, you know, here's sex with girls. He was just like really absent through that period, you know,
traveling all the time.
Mm. Yeah. And I didn't, and I thought my mom was kind of a pushover and I thought he was kind of stern and a disciplinarian. So it wasn't like there was any conscious, wow, I really wish my dad was around right now because I need his guidance. It was like, good, my dad's gone. I can do what I want, right. You know? And I didn't realize the costs of that then. It was just like, maybe it felt a little bit bad, but it was more convenient than anything else.
But you weren't getting the guidance that you needed at a crucial point in your life.
Absolutely not.
You probably knew at some level that he was escaping.
Yeah, possibly. So technically this did not happen before I was 18 years old, but it would be really, really hard for me to answer no for this question. I mean, if my parents, you know, I think had maybe been more honest with themselves, they would have gotten divorced when I was like 7 or 8.
Just because parents are not separated or divorced doesn't mean they're happily in a love relationship with each other, right?
Yep.
A lot of statistics being thrown around about the benefits of marriage.
Sure.
You know?
Just by default, that supposedly, statistically, leads to more functional children, I guess.
Mm.
Well-adjusted, you could say, which means they do well in school.
By the time I was 18, I was out. You know, I was in college, and then I lived where I went to college for about a decade afterwards. Mm. And I didn't return back to this area until like 2006. So in that time, I had minimal contact with my family. I mean, I came home on holidays, but, you know, my parents separated. My mom went to therapy. She really became very independent. My dad found somebody who was a better partner for him that wouldn't, I hate to use he wound up in a relationship that had a better dynamic than what he had with my mother and seemed happier and seemed like they both changed in really positive ways by not being married anymore. And I have kind of wondered what it would have been like for me to have experienced that when I was 9, these happy, more self-actualized people than experiencing it instead when I was like 29, you know? When it didn't really matter as much anymore. So.
Zero on that one for me. I think this next question is interesting. It says, was your mother or stepmother? Did you find that odd? Why it's on the mother side?
You can read the whole thing.
And yeah, do you mind?
Yeah, sure.
It says, was your mother or stepmother often or very often pushed, slapped or had something thrown at her, sometimes or very often kicked, beaten,
bitten.
Or bitten?
Yeah.
Oh, well, hit with a fist or hit with something hard, ever repeatedly hit at least a few times or threatened with a gun or knife. There's actually some statistics now that show that men are often abused in the household as well. So that's,
yeah.
They could have made that either way, but I think this fits the stereotype a little bit better.
mother or stepmother. So they're really kind of getting, trying to get a profile of the father figure in that scenario. Yeah.
Right. That's a no for me.
Yeah. No for me as well.
Yeah. That's definitely a no for me too.
We did have a lot of guns around in the house. You know, they're kind of like a, just a permanent fixture, you know, and actually my mom and dad hunted with each other and there were no mishaps. There was no two go out, one comes back trips. Yeah.
The next one. Did you ever live with anyone who was a problem drinker or alcoholic or who used street drugs? Matt, you can start.
That's a no for me. I mean, they did drink, but the definition of an alcoholic, I wonder what that is, but it wasn't obvious that nothing happened because of that with me.
Yeah. What is the difference between a problem drinker and an alcoholic? You know, or they're saying or, but they didn't have a comma there, so it's not equivalent. You know, what does it mean in terms of attending to the child's needs? How much is the parent checking out from that emotional relationship with the child? Even checking in to think, to basically say, how is this, what I'm doing, this drinking, affecting you emotionally? What's coming up for you when you see me drinking like this? You know? Yeah. Typically, there's not that. And it's interesting that they say street drugs and they don't add pharmaceutical drugs because that's really prevalent in our society today. Antidepressants and anxiety drugs. All that stuff are subject to abuse.
Scary how much less of an issue it would have been 20 years ago, just 20 years ago when the study was developed. You know,
true.
I mean, the growth in, we talked about this in my last show, the growth in drug prescriptions for children under 13 skyrocketed since the time that I was in high school. So adult prescription drug use is probably moving up at even, you know, a faster rate. And I think things like problem drinker or alcoholic are labels. And, you know, labels are not always very helpful in evaluating this. My father would have identified as an alcoholic, as a functional alcoholic. My brother, my middle brother would have identified the same way. That label, I've never liked it, but drinking has not been, you know, a positive part of my life at all. And honestly, for most of the last 16 years, you know, I used to use the word alcoholic. I used to go to AA meetings. I don't think I've ever talked about this on the show before, but I mean, I started making an effort to stop drinking when I was 21 years old. And I remember being in college and 19 years old and having done something really embarrassing as a result of being drunk and telling my friends that I think I've hit rock bottom. 19.
Did you do that? Did you say that after the fact or during?
It was, I think it was like one of the first times I had been involved in a binge drinking situation and I was really scared that I had kind of lost control so completely.
Yeah.
I remember it had gone on for a couple of days to a point where there was concern in a college setting around college friends, right? So college setting, who notices anybody doing anything like
dude,
that?
You're outdoing us.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But also like somebody saying, are you okay? And these weren't even like great friends. I mean, most of the friendships were built around partying together. So I actually had this conversation with my father about drinking. And, you know, he said to me, alcoholism is genetic and you know how I feel about drinking and it's affected you and it's affected your brother, you know, and this was actually the doorway into this conversation about the transfer of trauma. This wasn't even that long ago that we had this conversation. And I said, is it really that? And maybe there is some kind of genetic relationship with this opioid receptor in the brain that in certain people, and it does pass genetically, but is it more of a transfer of trauma thing? And I explained that to him. You know, I didn't have that vocabulary or that emotional intelligence when I first had therapy when I was 21. Which was substance abuse counseling mandated by law because I had gotten a DWI when I was 18, you know, and I dragged my feet. They said, okay, if you want your license back, you have to go to substance abuse counseling and you have to go to AA for 4 months, you know, and I was a sophomore in college when they told me that. So I was like, fuck that. I'm not doing that because I'm going to find stuff. I mean, I think I knew deep down that I was going to find out stuff there. And I had to go to like a course for a weekend to get my license back. I remember how hard it was, like being pulled out of college where I was drinking like every day and then have to stay sober for 2 days. I think I slept for like 4 hours the whole time, you know, and they told me, they said, lie. The people who knew what I was doing like at college, they said, lie about everything. Tell them somebody spiked the punch at a party. You never drink. Nobody in your family drinks if you want your license back. And I wound up being honest with them about it. I said, I'm kind of worried about, you know, some of the things I'm doing. And they said, before you get your license back, you have to go to AA for 4 months. You have to get this piece of paper signed every time you go, and you have to see a substance abuse counselor for the same amount of time. So I went to see this counselor, and he started asking me questions like, tell me about your family. And I was like, what is this, like small talk, like getting to know you kind of stuff? Like, I got, you know, got problems now, you know, with drinking. And he said, that was the key to everything. And I remember just in this kind of contentious moment with my parents, I said, basically, it's your fault that I'm like this when I was 21, you know? And my dad was like, well, that kind of sucks because I'm paying for this, you know, not exactly the outcome I was looking for, you know, to be blamed. And I actually, you know, I talked to him not too long ago about that. I said, you know, when I was kind of going through that stuff as a young man, I didn't have the vocabulary, you know, to explain how trouble in families transfers if it's unevaluated, because we don't know how. And no one has a child and says, I'm going to do a bad job.
No.
They just do.
They go because with the best of intentions.
Because their own trauma is triggered, you know, by all of the stressful experiences. Just being responsible for keeping a child alive is stressful enough. Then you have to put them through school, and you have to like be an enforcer for the school and let that, you know, sabotage the relationship you could have with them. Let, you know, that experience becomes a stressor in your parents' relationship, because none of those values have maybe ever been clarified. About like, what should we do in these situations? Should we spank? Should we not? So it's all hard enough. But when all their own undealt with trauma is re-triggered or triggered and reenacted, it's passed along. So I explained that to him, you know, and I actually did it using my mother's family as an example, because I thought there might be more buy-in with that. And there was. And then I switched and I said, you know, and you had this experience, you know, your mother was an alcoholic. Your dad died when you were 5. You know, and he understood, and he said things like, yeah, I guess whatever came to you passed through me, you know, and we are the sum. He said, we're the sum of our parts. So what are our parts? And he's never read The Body Keeps the Score. It was just his words, you know, so he actually understood it.
Did he decouple a bit from that genetic argument and just focus on the mental and behavioral and what was alive in him?
It was an interesting thing to do, and maybe that's why I started with my mother's family, right? Because he gets an answer, like most people, a lot of people his age, they get an answer they're comfortable with, you know, like it's the Groundhog Day of the political conversations, where he'll be interested, and I'll talk to him about libertarianism, and then, you know, the next time I'll see him, he'll be like, hey, how about that Mitt Romney? You know, like he just kind of goes back. He goes back to where he's comfortable. Like you said, he just kind of resets to. So he had an answer that he liked, and it was a little bit, I had to carefully figure out how to get him to pull away from that a little bit. Genetics could be a part of it. There's no doubt in my mind, but it could be about something else too, is the point.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, essentially it's the mental process. Yeah. Like, how many times did he check in with you and say, Brett, I'm really wondering how my drinking is affecting you. Like, what are you feeling about this?
One of the things was, it was never until he saw me drink. Like, he wouldn't have said anything like that until he saw me and my brothers drink, you know?
Yeah.
And he said to me one time, like, I remember picking up in college, and like, you would smell like booze. And I just thought that was part of being in college. And I was just like you when I was that age.
Sure. But so normalizing all of that.
Yeah. So there was never any conversation about the effect that it was having on me. But you were in a similar situation, right?
Yeah, well, there was really no, I mean, I tried to talk to my dad about later on, you know, after they had divorced, and he dated a gal for like 8 years, and he got married, and then within a year had it annulled. Mm-hmm. So there was lots of unaddressed issues within his own psyche, and he never really abandoned the Catholic perspective. Like, he was raised Catholic, but he didn't really go to church, but he was still a believer, and he was dismayed that I didn't get baptized. So when I went down to SMU... first year in college, he wanted me to do that. That's kind of the hedge, right? And I remember talking to one of the religious guys there on campus, and I had some interesting questions for him, and he didn't really answer them to my satisfaction. So we had to talk about that, and he had to make peace with the metaphysical naturalism perspective that I had, you know, rejecting all of those sacrificial memes. But I don't think he really ever came to terms with all that, and... he knew it was a problem, and he thought that he could fix it on his own. But 2 years before he died, you know, his doctor said, if you keep drinking, you're going to be dead in 2 years.
Yeah.
And that was a pretty accurate prediction. So, yeah, I mean, it takes a toll on individuals and on family systems, for sure. It's really about the emotions and how much connection with the inside is there, you know? And I think with that, the AA model, this alcoholism label, the diagnosis, that's sort of this easy way, I guess, to explain it. But it doesn't really get at the trauma, I don't believe. Like, I think people, even after they've become sober and they're no longer using this substance, depending on it for more ease and comfort in their lives or to deal with the pain that they may feel, mm-hmm. They still consider themselves alcoholics, right? Like one drink away from going back to that. So I don't think that is a real healthy model to understand the self.
It's a hypervigilance, you know? Yeah. And it is a version of, it is a part of self. It's like a guard that stands watch. Mm-hmm. With a gun, scanning mm-hmm. the horizon.
Very distrustful of parts of self.
And fearful. Right? And fearful. And, you know, I said I used to go to these meetings and I would hear people talk, and I can't tell you how many times I heard, like, something that would have been identified as a character defect introduced to the group by the person saying, well, I'm an alcoholic, so you know how we are.
Yeah. Explains everything.
Yeah, and that was such a...
I have this gene, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Even though there's not really a definitive understanding of how genetics plays into these kinds of behaviors. I mean, you look at Thomas Saws has a whole book on the myth of mental illness, taking issue with a lot of these diagnostic labels. Mm. And I don't think they really get us to where we need to go is the integration, you know, and the understanding, the attunement to those emotions that weren't attuned to early on. So how did we cope with that?
Yeah.
What did we reach for to deal with it?
But we're going to see in when we get to the results of the ACE study how much more likely abused children are to use drugs or to drink, you know. And I had a similar, you know, that has to have something to do with what you experienced, Brett. And I thank you so much for sharing, and it's terrible. And all I can say is I have this very similar experience. I had to go home at 19 and tell my dad I spend the night in jail for, you know, drinking, basically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't get much, and, you know, I don't know what I was looking for, but, you know, I think that a lot of it, you know, you look back now and you say, well, why did I do that? Why, you know, I would never see my kids ever doing that. You know, how was I so different that I would do something like that? Why are these people that suffer these A scores doing the things that they do? You know, there's something in their brain has changed with all the stress that they've seen. So they're trying to get attention, their survival skills, what the IFS would say is that they're not really managing their subparts, internal family systems. So
sometimes it's escape. Like, you try to live consciously, you try to be responsible for yourself. And, you know, my relationship with drinking, like, there was a time when I would go to AA and I would stay sober. And I mean, I've lived almost, like, I think it's fair to say that I've lived almost all of my life for the last 16 years sober, but not entirely. And the times that I didn't were very costly, very, very costly. They were, you know, kind of short binges, but it's amazing what you can undo in a couple of years of hard work staying away from this, in just a few days of not abstaining. Mm. But when I went to AA, I would stay sober. I would write in the journal. I would pray to God.
And you've got a support group, right?
And you've got a support group. But something happened, you know, like 10 years ago where I was like, why am I writing down that I believe in God? I don't. This actually feels kind of silly. And I didn't feel sincere about anything that I was doing. And there was this interesting, I would describe it today as this path. And a lot of people who go to those meetings, and even people who do substance abuse counseling but aren't on board with the AA model, they would say that, you know, part of whatever this thing is this voice you're going to hear that tells you you can keep doing it, you know, that tells you the next time will be different. Like, forget what you heard about insanity. This is like a separate thing. You can do it. You can do it. So I remember getting away from God, which I don't like the way I said that. I got away from God. It's like, I remember this time where I got away from God, but I got back. As I realized I was an atheist, and I realized how integrated it was, the religion was in AA, no matter what they say, or at least that was my experience with it, the whole higher power thing, the whole sacrifice thing. The next thing I got away from was that. And so I said, okay, well, that was probably bullshit. So the whole alcoholism thing is probably bullshit too. so I could probably drink. I remember I came here.
Oh, wow. So that led to it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And I remember I came here in 2010 and I had been sober, I don't know, 4 years at that point, and had tried drinking a little bit like 4 years earlier, and then been sober like 5 years at that point, and was just kind of, you know, and I'm not saying I came here and then this happened. Like, it was my responsibility. It's my responsibility to treat myself best in every new situation I enter in life, regardless of what the challenges were. But I saw a lot of people just normalizing and kinds of behavior and making it look very consequence-free and attractive. And I wasn't prepared to deal with that, you know? And I struggled for years, and it was hard to find the right things to do. I'm doing them now, but when I was new to like this scene, I did not do a good job with that at all. So
I think that's a really important point. And Gerlach, to his credit, brings up the 12 steps in trying to get over addiction as very important, and
he does.
To substitute God for something. You know, he says, here's an exercise. Go through the 12 steps that are written down here and substitute out God for something else.
So I had an objectivist friend in San Diego that used reason as his higher power.
Or, what is purpose, human purpose? And we could maybe talk about that some other time. But there is purpose that drives us as human beings, as life forms, you know, forward. And, you know, that's what I put in there. Mm-hmm. And because the 12 steps, I think, it helped you, yeah?
It did for a time, yeah. And there are alternatives now, and there are, you know, therapists who are on board with alternatives. There's something called SMART recovery, and that's something that I'm still involved in, and it's all based on cognitive behavioral therapy. It seemed like it was either, and that was kind of a message of AA, it's either this or drinking and death, and that turned out not to be the case.
Yeah, there's a lot of fear tactics, a lot of distrust. I disagree with the nature of the model in terms of psychological well-being. I think that it contains some flawed premises about the self, like setting up this adversarial relationship that may exist due to trauma, but what we need to do is integrate rather than say that you're powerless in some way, like in an act of irony, you're powerless to help yourself. You know, I think that's kind of disempowering, and it creates this dependence on others, for instance, instead of yourself. So there's less self-reliance, and it's always like you're hanging in the balance, right, of falling off the wagon again. And you're always an alcoholic. I mean, the labeling, I think, is pretty antithetical to a healthy self-concept.
Yeah, you're defective.
Yeah.
I'm an alcoholic, and you know how we are, and you're that guard in the tower.
And that guard is not, you know, a place of healthy integration. You know, Bessel talks about, and the body keeps a score, the watchtower, these frontal lobes that we have that are monitoring and noticing the things that we do and the things that we don't do. And how is it relating to our emotions?
Yeah.
I think that sort of mindfulness to be attending to the things that are coming to our consciousness and to our bodies, you know, the feelings that we have, and to make sure that we're taking time in for ourselves or treating ourselves with kindness and empathy. You know, which we're not used to typically in this culture. You know, when we talk about all these domination systems, they're not filled with kindness and empathy. They're filled with punishment and disconnection, disintegration, dissociation, and, you know, a lot of harmful stuff.
Yeah, I don't want to get too far ahead here, but I think it's an important point to bring up in this ACE, kind of the results. And one of the things that I think is so important about this ACE study is that it shows outcomes when you're an adult, and how much higher the odds are you having been, you know, suffered through some of the trauma that you had as a child. And one of the health problems is considers self an alcoholic. And if you have four or more on the ACE score, which I think we're up to almost for you.
This would have been four.
So, I mean, the odds ratio, you have 7.4 times more to be consider yourself an alcoholic. You know, for your dad to say genetics.
Yeah.
And, you know, that just throws away all of this, which is, those are some pretty astronomical figures that I'm looking at on this ACE outcomes. And, you know, I had the same thing. But, you know, my ACE score is not high. If you looked at Brandon's score, it would be.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and he didn't really tally them, like, you know, he didn't subject it to empirical investigation like these folks did. And I think that it would have been helpful. And it might be part of this process of evolution, you know, to attune more to the essential aspects of one's youth and the parenting process. I was up at Dartmouth the other night, and this researcher, Alan Shore, discussed, his talk was early relationships and lifelong health. So he spent a lot of time talking about the neuroscience behind human connection as an infant. And, you know, the mother typically is the caregiver while breastfeeding and so forth. And it was pretty interesting scientifically. I asked him if there's any kind of in the works an infant, adverse infant experiences score. And he said, perhaps, you know, that's the next thing they can work on. But that would entail asking the caregiver, you know, how resourceful are you feeling as your child cries or keeps you up at night and has these aspects that part of you feels really overwhelmed by or nervous or fearful or angry? You know, how are you dealing with that? So really giving empathy for the caregivers to the caregivers. Yeah, and they can be resourceful then.
I'm glad that you brought that up. That's a very important point. I would love to see some empirical data on that. There are some studies, but not nearly enough on that, on all that a baby needs, and if they don't get it, the effects later in life.
Yeah, because there is research that shows that a disturbingly high percentage of parents actually punish infants, even if it's just love withdrawal, like the little micro interactions. Mm-hmm. Where something happens and the parent gets upset, turns away, and then the child notices all this. And of course, they get back attuned. To what extent is that affecting the neurology as well?
Those studies that they do with the mother puts on a stoic face just for a second. And then the baby goes crazy because he's not getting their needs met. And then the mother kind of goes back into it and says, you know, and then attunes to the baby.
Yeah, it can be mother or father, obviously, but typically it's mother during the earliest time. And then the sort of wanting of connection, mother wants connection or father wants connection, and they kind of push the issue. The child just wants space, but doesn't get it.
Right.
And it gets overwhelmed and then cries. And then those kinds of things can lead to more and more building up of these potential adverse childhood experiences where there's less and less empathy and understanding of what's really going on emotionally for everyone.
Hmm. Anything else on that one?
No, two more.
The ninth one, was a household member depressed or mentally ill, or did a household member attempt suicide? It's kind of a challenging one to answer. I mean, no one in my family ever received a diagnosis.
Clinical
label. Diagnosis from a psychiatrist.
And what is mental illness in this culture?
Yeah, that's true.
The pathology of normalcy?
Yeah. I mean, when I was little, my mom seemed depressed. My dad seemed to be obsessive and compulsive, but neither one of them were ever medicated for it, you know? So I don't know how to, I mean, I guess that's a no. It didn't ask me how I felt. I mean, it's kind of more framed in an objective way. No one was ever locked away in a straitjacket. I never saw either of them be violent or even rude to other adults.
Yeah, I'm a no for this one too, although I think we can look at the nature of mental illness and put in most people in this culture because of the domination systems that are so prevalent and so just normalized in this culture, you know? Trauma researchers speaking favorably of the schooling process, you know, not honoring the child's intrinsic motivation to learn. And if we don't get over that hurdle, we'll never have this free world, because people will always be looking to others to obey and to do assignments from, you know, to take orders and not think for themselves and not think outside this, you know, statist box, this coercive system that supposedly is designed for our well-being, but actually contains all the seeds of our destruction with the distrust and the disrespect of the needs for choice and autonomy and everything else that's related to that. Self-esteem, for instance.
So when people say mental illness, you know, we typically think about something that's pretty extreme, something that looks pretty crazy. We don't talk about mental wellness. We all just kind of assume like, yeah, we're whatever, but some people are crazy.
Exactly.
You know?
So I'm a no until after I was 18 on the suicide on that one. And probably depression too, but after 18.
The last one, did a household member go to prison?
Negative.
Nope.
Nope. It got me thinking, too. I think this is a worthwhile exercise because it can bring up memories, like things like that just completely, there's just been no room for in the consciousness. I remember this time I woke up in the middle of the night and I heard my dad talking to my mom and a group of people. It was like mid-1980s. He had gone to Los Angeles because he'd gotten sued for some copyright infringement thing for some company. Trial was out there. And I woke up and I heard him talking about getting arrested by the LAPD for driving under the influence. And I just by reading this question, it was like right in the front of my mind, that experience. I remember another time where he ran another business and he was having problems with the people who owned the warehouse. And in the middle of the night, and he had been locked out of the warehouse where he had been storing equipment. So in the middle of the night, him and the other management in his company went to the warehouse with bolt cutters, broke the locks, and moved all their equipment stuff out in moving trucks overnight. And he got arrested for trespassing. And I remember my mom. And it was like after like a really difficult period financially for my family, you know, he was running this failing business. And there was like obviously more stress between my parents. And I just remember this like event that was like this break for me where my mom hangs up the phone and she says, your father's in jail. And I was probably 12. And it was like, it was that matter of fact. Okay, bye. Your father's in jail.
And how do you feel?
I remember I just cried. I remembered I said something like, how long is this going to go on for? How long is it going to be like this? I mean, I grew up, I was like a rich kid. You know, we had everything we wanted. And my dad sold a company that he owned and bought some other company and went bankrupt and went to jail one day for a day. I didn't know it was only going to be a day when my mom said, your dad's in jail.
But even that's a long time for a child, right? And yeah. Not knowing when it's going to happen again.
Yeah.
But that's an A score, right?
No. Did a household member ever go to prison? No.
Well, is jail prison?
I would say no. I mean,
I would say that's a traumatic experience you had because to lose a caregiver like that and not know what the future holds, right? That's the survival aspect that's being jeopardized for a child.
Yeah, and it was kind of like a last straw too. It's like with the family has been like so, you know, there's been so much upheaval because of this. And now this, is this how it ends? Does it get worse after this? It certainly seemed like an escalation to me. So it was a worthwhile exercise. And I'm just kind of piggybacking on what Matt said about, you know, scoring Brandon's questions. You know, just going through this exercise brings up a lot for me. And yeah. I hope it's, you know, a worthwhile and educational experience for others as well. But
puts it on the radar.
Adding to it, yeah, the breaking free questions really might be, I think, a meaningful completion exercise. And of course, picking up this book, The Art of Self-Discovery, is really a helpful way to do this self-evaluation as well.
Yeah, that can open up a whole new world inside. In this continent called the subconscious can be explored. I was going to say, in relation to number 10, there's a tangential, even more essential question from our perspective as liberty lovers, which is, did any household members believe in the idea of prison?
Yeah.
You know, the punishment model, the punishment paradigm is the mainstay in our culture. And we need to get past that to get to a free world.
Absolutely.
To treat people as bad and wrong and throw them in a cage is not about restorative justice. That's just retribution. And the punishments are arbitrary. They're not even so-called just and consistent.
And look who pays. You know, based on this, the people that pay are the children. The children pay for that
huge,
type of abuse.
Huge. So is that justice?
Yeah, no. Before we go to the questions, if you don't mind, Brett, I think we should just spend a minute or two on the outcomes, the health outcomes of people that have these A scores. Because this is what woke me up finally. And if there was something in the water or, you know, in these bottles of water that we drink that would cause your life expectancy to go down by 20 years, or for you to have a 3 or 4 times greater rate of heart disease or lung disease, we'd be going bananas.
Or a 30 times greater rate of suicide.
Yeah.
I think that's after you get 6 ACEs.
Right.
Yeah, it's off the charts.
When I heard those numbers, I'm like, what? How come I have never heard this? how come I have never heard these causal relationships?
Yeah, why isn't the medical community up in arms about it?
Good question. This is beyond their training.
And beyond their unprocessed trauma, sort of. I mean, they've not really focused on that. You know, the whole med school process is not about how to heal our trauma first and then learn how to be attentive to patients, their needs, physically and psychologically. So it's just another domination system that's set up as kind of a racket that isn't accountable to customers ultimately. And it's just really dismaying. It kind of pisses me off, actually, that these trauma researchers advocate universal healthcare when there's an abundance of books and resources out there to show just how horrible that will be or is. I mean, we have a semi-socialized system now, and it's a race to the bottom. It's not about creating abundance for people. If anybody's doing that, it's the people in the tech sector with all these healthcare projects, you know, that they want to bring to market, but they're caught up in the red tape of the regulatory nonsense.
So 2/3 of people have an A score. The number that I found off the charts is the sexual percentage or the prevalence. 22% reported yes to intercourse, oral, touch their body in a sexual way. You know, most of it was touching or fondling, but that is a huge number.
Mm-hmm.
22%.
And those are the ones that reported it. I think these are conservative estimates or figures here. I mean, that relates to the Alan Shore presentation
number.
I listened to where he, you know, the researchers say there's 75% of the American public are securely attached while admitting that over 90% are physically punished and subjected to love withdrawal and a whole bunch of other things that sacrifice needs. I mean, there's just a lot of disconnection in the psychological community. But even if you take these scores as valid, as somehow accurate, it's terrible.
We may quibble with some of the questions, but the way that they conducted the study, and it's a blunt instrument, but it's, you can't believe the numbers.
It's a powerful one. Yeah,
yeah, it's very powerful.
When you see the correlations with scores, I mean, we're looking at, you know, charts right here, and people who are watching the video can see them on the screen. A score of four or higher on the ACE, the results were 16% of those people were alcoholics versus a one where it was like between 5 and 6%.
And a 0, 2%.
0, 2%.
Yeah. So 8 times.
Yeah, that's the acestoohigh.com page. And they have a couple paragraphs here that are pertinent. As your ACE score increases, so does the risk of disease, social, and emotional problems. With an ACE score of 4 or more, things start getting serious.
Yeah.
The likelihood of chronic pulmonary lung disease increases 390%. Hepatitis, 240%, depression, 460%, suicide, 1,220%. By the way, lest you think that the ACE study was yet another involving inner city poor people of color, take note. The study's participants were 17,000 mostly white, middle and upper middle class, college educated San Diegans with good jobs and great health care. They all belong to the Kaiser Permanente Health Maintenance Organization. So, yeah, this is kind of the tip of the iceberg. And I would say this cohort, that group of subjects, is sort of prone to perhaps a bit of dissembling, to not really coming to terms with the truth. You know, I've met quite a few people in this group, and being in the mainstream like that and buying into all the bullshit in the culture and all the systems of domination can lend itself to not being really honest and open about a lot of this stuff.
Mm. And industries and societies compartmentalize just like individuals do.
Yeah.
You know, there's people who are completely walled off from, you know, especially if you're being put through the rigors of like some medical career. How much reading have you done on the economics of, I mean, I guess maybe a universal healthcare would be something that you would look into, but I guarantee you there's people who are going through medical programs right now and they have no awareness of that. You know, they've never studied that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just like, sorry, not my division of labor. I know what mine is and it's filling my time.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
so I don't have time for personal research projects almost.
Yeah. In contrast, there is a receptivity to these questions. Most people across the board like being asked these really important questions about their childhoods, it turns out. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons, or maybe the excuses that the medical profession gives for why they haven't asked them in the past. It was like too intrusive into, you know, they're not the therapists of the patients. But if it has such a bearing on physical health, not to mention mental health, why wouldn't you ask questions like this?
Right. Yeah. Well, I think it does make people nervous. And I think I understand some of those fears for maybe what we could call, like, for lack of a better term, the Alex Jones crowd. In this case, I think even those fears are fairly valid. Like, as the state and medicine become more intertwined, I think there's validity to a nervousness that people might have about being asked personal questions. So I want to just acknowledge that and say that there's certainly understanding for that. Mm-hmm. As the government and medicine become more of the, they join together to become more of this pry bar into people's personal lives. Yeah, I could see this making people nervous. So it's nice that it gets some validity from Kaiser Permanente. This conversation gets some validity from Kaiser Permanente and the CDC. But that's also going to scare a lot of people too, which is unfortunate.
But for many people, this was the first time that they've ever talked about this in a written letter that was mailed to them by their HMO.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is sad because people do want to help each other. People do want to talk about this. This is why we are communicating traumas, because we can't talk about it. And if we can talk about it and talk to a trusted person about what's on your mind and about what kind of grooves that you're in that you can't get out, or ruts that you're in that you can't get out, that's the way to start turning things around. And we were talking about some of these kids that where the stress was so great that it changed their brain. That's going to be a tough road for them. And I think a lot of these people that have had multiple ACE scores, even though they want to talk about it, they're very afraid. If you look at some of the comments on the links that you shared, Brett, it's sad.
Yeah, on this acestoohigh.com, I mean, the bulk of the page, 645 comments on this thing, and it's just a trail of tears. It's so tragic. And this is a self-selected sample, of course. And also, you know, even if you don't have any ACEs, ostensibly, it doesn't mean that you aren't going to be a smoker or alcoholic, you know, as it's defined, patterns of behavior that can be pretty costly, you know?
Right.
So it's not necessarily one-to-one correlation, shall we say.
Do you mind if I do the resilience questionnaire real quick and read the first comment? Because it was very moving for me.
Sure.
Sure, absolutely.
So there's a resilience questionnaire at the bottom of acestoohigh.com. They have a series of questions here. One, I believe my mother loved me when I was little. I believe my father loved me when I was little. Other people helped my mother and father. I've heard that when I was an infant, someone from the family enjoyed playing with me. And it goes on. When I was a child, there were relatives that made me feel better if I was sad or worried. When I was a child, neighborhood, my friend's parents used to seem to like me. When I was a child, teachers, coaches, youth leaders, ministers were there to help me. Someone in my family cared about how I was doing in school. My family, neighbors, and friends talked about making our lives better. We had rules in our home and were expected to keep them. When I felt really bad, I could always find someone I trusted to talk to. As a youth, people noticed I was capable about getting things done. I was independent, and I believe life is what you make it. So these are ways that I think what they're saying is to make yourself resilient to these ACE scores happening. And you're supposed to say definitely true, probably true. And if it's one of those, then you get a point there. So there are 14 questions, and I think, you know, some people might get a high score. And this first guy said, I got a score of 6 on the ACE and a resilient score of 1. He continues, his name is Frank. It's been a terrible life of starving for intimacy. I'm getting older now. I've done 1,000 hours of therapy and read tons of books and done research and tried a lot to improve my well-being. I needed and was ready for an intimate life partner long ago, but God had no such thing in store for me. On the contrary, suffering under the Christian convictions that it is a sin to have intimacy or even think of it or to watch a video has been a living hell. If you don't find the nourishing intimacy you need when it's needed, this kind of research and self-awareness only makes things worse. These days, I often wish I never discovered the problem was and that I had been starving for the intimacy all my life.
Yeah, feeling at a loss. And it's sad that after 1,000 hours of therapy, there wasn't, you know, more integration and healing that can happen, actually. And, you know, that gets to kind of like our segue into the, what do you do with these scores? You know, how do you cope with the facts of your childhood, the memories that you have? That's really what it boils down to. How these memories are residing in your mind, how you're coping with them, what strategies are you using to deal with the feelings that are coming up from them, you know, and how people are relating to you as a consequence. So, You know, I've mentioned on my show in the trauma series that, you know, doing psychodrama, psychomotor therapy, where you're in a group of group setting, is like group therapy in a sense, where other people role play. This is actually constructive role playing, where they role play your parents or any significant person that was part of that traumatic experience, and you relive it with creating a new memory of it based on how they're relating to you in a different way. So they could role play the same parent in the same situation, but then switch into an ideal parent. For instance, if I were your ideal parent, I would have made sure that you were safe, cared for, protected, that, you know, you would have been intimately nurtured in a way that you would feel connected with other people. You know, and to hear that coming from another person, even if it's in a role play, it has a dramatic effect, because it can sit alongside those traumatic memories and actually, you know, sort of degrade the significance of them.
Yeah. A lot of it is, I think, about making things explicit too, you know?
Yeah.
Like a lot of these things just exist as sort of vague, nebulous feelings that kind of come in and then quickly swim away, you mm-hmm. know? And we never really get to experience them or label them and do it or see them, you know, if we don't label them. So being able to go through a process where we can do that, a lot of the solutions that we'll talk about in the next show, I think will sound a little awkward to people at first, you know, even internal family systems therapy or the self having distinct parts or doing these psychodramas. It's a challenge for people, but I really want to devote a fair amount of time to talking about The Body Keeps the Score, mm-hmm. The audiobook chapters that you sent me, which were two of the, chapter 17 huh? was like one of the most moving experiences nonfiction reading in my life. So that's going to be a big part of the next show, the concluding part of this.
I'm glad I was able to break DRM for this project.
DRM?
Digital Rights Management.
Wow, yes.
Because Audible files are supposedly not, you know, able to be cracked and create, you know, other files replicated. But yeah. This is such an important aspect. And, you know, it's something that we can all focus on and heal from.
Absolutely. I'm also glad, just in a final note, that I have a system that allows me to accept things from a mind like yours. Our minds work differently. And I was saying to Matt before you got here, I said, it seems like Wes can store a lot in his mind. And sometimes, you know, he'll...
Hyperactive hippocampus.
Yeah, well, you'll give me stuff. And I think I said, like, there's certain people in my life who I'm kind of feel like I'm like, no more, not yet. Just, I want it, but not yet.
Pull back the avalanche.
Right. So I'm glad I have a system of capturing and making useful all these really valuable things.
I got my own little container in your Evernote, don't I?
You definitely have a tag. There's okay, definitely cool. A tag, Wes.
Glad I have a tag.
And I need to use tags better. So when you say, do you remember the time we were talking about this? I could just click your tag and then I could not really claim to remember, but at least be able to see the record of it. So yeah, I really appreciate you, you know, doing a lot of the heavy lifting and the legwork to find these resources and check these things out. And this is a really valuable contribution to School Sucks. And Matt, thank you so much for sharing everything you did. And I just thought that show the two of you guys did together to conclude the trauma series was like one of the best podcasts that I ever heard. It was like, that was your first time on the show. It was like you had co-hosted 211 episodes together. Just what a good match it was, that conversation.
Wes and I have had many conversations by pools over dinner, and so that just felt like something else, and my credit to Wes for that.
Yeah, first time we met was over the Atlantic, actually.
Yeah.
On that cruise ship.
That's right. Okay, I was trying to remember that. Thank you so much for sharing a lot of that stuff. It sounds like it was the first time.
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome. I feel very honored to be between you two.
Yeah, thank I appreciate you. The sharing, too.
So end of hour three, end of day one. And we've got more to do.
That's
so
a wrap.
We'll reconvene soon. Thanks for listening, everybody. So we conclude today with another excerpt, this time a very brief one from chapter 17 of The Body Keeps the Score. And this excerpt is really set up for our next two discussions, parts 4 and 5. Yes, there is a fifth part in this series now, where we will go into detail on internal family systems therapy, IFS. And I'm hoping before the series concludes, you will get to hear all of chapter 17.
So this clip is only about 4 minutes long, but I'm going to wind it back 30 seconds into what you heard last time, and we'll pick up again at the end of this week. Here we go.
The role of therapists is to collaborate rather than teach, confront, or fill holes in your psyche. The first step in this collaboration is to assure the internal system that all parts are welcome and that all of them, even those that are suicidal or destructive, were formed in an attempt to protect the self system, no matter how much they now seem to threaten it. Self-leadership. IFS recognizes that the cultivation of mindful self-leadership is the foundation for healing from trauma. Mindfulness not only makes it possible to survey our internal landscape with compassion and curiosity, but can also actively steer us in the right direction for self-care. All systems, families, organizations, or nations, can operate effectively only if they have clearly defined and competent leadership. The internal family is no different. All facets of ourselves need to be attended to. The internal leader must wisely distribute the available resources and supply a vision for the whole that takes all the parts into account. As Richard Swartz explains, the internal system of an abuse victim differs from the non-abuse system with regard to the consistent absence of effective leadership, the extreme rules under which the parts function, and the absence of any consistent balance or harmony. Typically, the parts operate around outdated assumptions and beliefs derived from the childhood abuse, believing, for example, that it is still extremely dangerous to reveal secrets about childhood experiences which were endured. What happens when the self is no longer in charge? IFS calls this blending, a condition in which the self identifies with a part, as in, I want to kill myself, or I hate you. Notice the difference from a part of me wishes that I were dead, or a part of me triggers when you do that and makes me want to kill you. Schwartz makes two assertions that extend the concept of mindfulness into the realm of active leadership. The first is that this self does not need to be cultivated or developed. Beneath the surface of the protective parts of trauma survivors, there exists an undamaged essence, a self that is confident, curious, and calm, a self that has been sheltered from destruction by the various protectors that have emerged in their efforts to ensure survival. Once those protectors trust that it is safe to separate, the self will spontaneously emerge, and the parts can be enlisted in the healing process. The second assumption is that, rather than being a passive observer, this mindful self can help reorganize the inner system and communicate with the parts in ways that help those parts trust that there is someone inside who can handle things. Again, neuroscience research shows that this is not just a metaphor. Mindfulness increases activation of the medial prefrontal cortex and decreases activation of structures like the amygdala that trigger our emotional responses. This increases our control over the emotional brain. Even more than encouraging a relationship between a therapist and a helpless patient, IFS focuses on cultivating an inner relationship between the self and the various protective parts. In this model of treatment, the self doesn't only witness or passively observe, as in some meditation traditions. It has an active leadership role. The self is like an orchestra conductor who helps all the parts to function harmoniously as a symphony rather than a cacophony.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please help us out by leaving a positive review on iTunes. If you were angered by the show, please help us out by leaving negative reviews everywhere. If you think this is an important message for students, for parents, or for the future of intellectual freedom, please consider supporting us at schoolsucksproject.com/AV. For $6 a month, you'll get access to hundreds of additional hours of content while helping us grow and spread this message further.